My friend and colleague, Professor Jeffrey Jowell, is probably not going to like me to say that, but probably the best-known constitutional lawyer in the British world, maybe even in the global world, maybe. And actually, just after X, just so you know, we are privileged today, but after X is going to go, after a little parenthesis in Spain, he's going to go to New York for a debate on global constitutionalism organized by the New York Bar with Justice Breyer and the U.S. Supreme Court. But anyway, Professor Jeffrey Jowell, although being known as a famous British constitutional lawyer, is not British. He's born in South Africa. He's a South African. And probably one important thing that he's done in his life as a constitutional lawyer was helping frame the South African constitution in the 1990s. And he was very active in there. But he was also very active in London. He was a dean at UCL, University College London, where he's now an emeritus professor of law. And he recently was the, founder and director of the Bingham Institute. Bingham is from former Lord Bingham, who was a famous member of the House of Lords. And also a very, progressive constitutional. Who believed in, I think, judicial review, which is not maybe too often the case in the UK. Also believe in modern constitutionalism, and I think Professor Jowell is probably one of the best British writer today on this new constitutionalism. He wrote several books, one of them, all have to work on the British institutions and constitution. This is the book of reference called The Changing Constitution. And it's published by Oxford Press. Is this a 215 edition? 215 edition. And it's also the author of, is it a treaty or is it a judicial review? Judicial review, is that considered a treatise or?
Yes, it is a treatise on administrative and constitutional.
Administrative and constitutional judicial review, both in dealing with the British experience and also the comparative also perspective. So it could be also a very good reference for you as well. And Professor Jowell is also an important international consultant, and we were talking this morning about different missions and that he had recently the opportunity to do, especially with in the Middle East and Myanmar also, and also recently with Brazil, where he was advising on the impeachment and also in general the fight against corruption there and how it was compatible with the rule of law, because they have some specific, maybe you'll say later things on that. And in Brazil, they have some specific ways that are not very compatible with rule of law requirements about pretrial detention to force people to speak about corruption. They put them in jail first, and then they discuss. So that's not very acceptable. That's perfectly accurate. Okay.
Any Brazilians
here? I have a few Brazilians. I don't know if you are here today. I don't see any Brazilian today. No, we have a Russian student, mostly French student. We have Italian students, I see here. Yeah. Who else do we have? We have a German student here, German lawyer student also. And the others are French PhD students or comparative law students, most of you. Anybody else from another country? Yes? Oh, Greece, of course. You are from Greece. Yeah. I have a tendency to think that you're also from Italy for some reason. I'm sorry. Yeah, from a Greek student. Afghanistan. Okay. Anybody else from faraway country? No. Okay. Yeah, where are you from? Burkina Faso. Okay. Professor Joel has probably worked extensively with lots of African situations as well, if you included Burkina Faso.
Kenya and Southern African states.
So we're very happy to have you today, and I'm going to give you the floor, and Professor Joel will be talking about a very current and major constitutional question regarding his first or second country, First now, okay. The United Kingdom, which is he called the battle between parliamentary sovereignty and the rule of law. So thank you very much. I leave you the floor.
Thank you very much. Now you can hear me. Good. Professor Scofani, as everything he said was reasonably accurate, except that I am the greatest constitutional lawyer in the world. He's number one as far as I am concerned. And I'm delighted.
Say that because they're not going to believe anything you say.
Anyway, I'm delighted to be here. It's a great honor and pleasure because not only because of the weather, which is better than London at the moment, and always will be, alas. But also because in the 1990s, I formed a liaison, a link between this university and my university, University of London, University College London. And as you will know, students have been exchanging over the years, and that's when I first met your great professor, Scofani, here. So it's been a great pleasure to be back here. The constitutional system of every country rests on history as well as on logic. And the British system rests on the fact that it has evolved. An evolution from an all-powerful king, queen, monarchy to a parliamentary democracy. And that transfer of power was not always peaceful, but we never had a proper revolution. We never had a proper revolution. At least no violent revolution. So it has been an evolution. That is good, but it is also bad. It is bad because we do not have any codification of our constitution. There's no one place you can say, this is the British constitution. People sometimes say we have no written constitution. Well, that's wrong because it's written in many different places. In laws, statute law from Parliament, in judge-made law, that's what we call the common law, the judge-made law, and in something we call convention, it's something in between law, basic principles. So in order to understand the British Constitution, you have to understand its fundamental values. And they provide these constitutional principles. And there are three main constitutional principles. The one is the presumption of liberty. It's a presumption of liberty. The second, the rule of law. You say, état de droit, would that be the best way to translate état de droit? And the third one is the sovereignty of Parliament. Let me start with the presumption of liberty. And what I'm going to do is to describe these very briefly and then talk about their interaction and conflict between them. Starting with the presumption of liberty, the British system is marked by the fact that everyone is free to do whatever they like unless there is a law that prohibits them from doing something. And as I said, there are many laws, but the presumption is freedom. So we have no allocated rights from the state. The rights are inherent in the country. These rights are not the gift of government, but they exist naturally. And this means that any public authority, public body, must have a clear basis in legality, in law, a legal basis for any action they take which infringes individual freedom. Now, for that reason, that is the reason why so many British people have not been in favor until recently of a Bill of Rights, of a constitutional Bill of Rights, the European Convention, for example. Because what they would say is, we have all the rights, and it's only government can override it. Otherwise, you're free, such as you have complete freedom of expression, freedom of movement. They are fundamental because you can only be stopped if there's a law stopping you from doing something. I'll come back to that in its practical application later. I'm going to end up by doing a case study, a cas concret, about the rights of prisoners to vote, which I know is an issue here in this country, it's an issue in Russia, it's an issue in Italy, the Scopola case before the European Court of Human Rights, in many countries, and that to me will be an interesting case study to see how all these different principles interact. Now, the second principle is the sovereignty of Parliament. And this principle says that you can do anything, Parliament can do anything, the legislature can do anything, except what's impossible. So Parliament cannot turn a man into a woman, but Parliament can do anything else it wishes. Why do we have that principle of parliamentary sovereignty? Not restrained, you understand, by any superior constitution. We're unique in the world on this. When I say unique, there are few countries who do not have a restraining constitution. One is New Zealand, Australia maybe, Israel, and that's about it. Every other country has the supremacy of the constitution. We have the supremacy of the legislature without any written constitution at all. Now, what is the basis of parliamentary sovereignty? It is the fact that Parliament is elected by the people. In 1885, a very famous British jurist and professor at Oxford University called Professor Dicey wrote his famous book about the Constitution. It's a famous book partly because nobody had written really before that much about our Constitution, because we didn't have a Constitution, no written, codified Constitution. But also, it was the beginning of a time when law degrees in the universities were first introduced. There were no law degrees until that time. And so his was the first basic treatise, the basic textbook on the subject. And it has had enormous influence over the years. And he said that sovereignty of Parliament is the most important principle. And he would base that, although he didn't spell it out too much, on the fact that Parliament was represented by people. That was the battle. It was between the people on the one hand and the kings and queens, the monarchy on the other. It was finally won by Parliament in the 19th century, and so parliamentary sovereignty was proclaimed as a liberating principle, not an oppressive principle, but a liberating principle for the people. Now, we might pause and say, in 1885, women did not have the vote at all, so it was not elected by universal franchise, but still it was now regarded, and people only who had the vote who had property, landed people, But nevertheless, it was regarded as the prime principle. And even more so when we extended the franchise to the whole population. And the third principle we have so far, presumption of liberty, that's the system. And then these two principles, the sovereignty of Parliament, and the other one is the rule of law, l'état de droit. Now, the rule of law is often criticized on the grounds that it is vague. What do we mean by the rule of law? And also, recently, it's criticized on the basis that it is a Western concept or a Northern concept, a concept for the developed world, but not for the underdeveloped world. And before we discuss that, what does the rule of law try to achieve? Well, basically, it says we are all under law and not under man or woman. Okay? So it's the law that governs us and not a tyrant or a despot or the king or the queen acting with total power. So it's saying you're governed. It's the notion of legality there rather than tyranny on the one side or anarchy on the other side. So that's where the rule of law sits. That's the main thrust of the rule of law. I'll come to its ingredients in a moment when I examine this question, is it vague and is it universal? But for the moment, let me just say that Dicey, I mentioned this great Dicey because all British textbooks still to this day begin with Dicey. He was opposed the rule of law in England in 1885 to what was going on in France. And he says, in his chapter on the rule of law, he said, if Voltaire or Montesquieu were to come, to England, as they did, as they visited England, he said, and these are his words, they would pass out of the realm of despotism and into a land where the laws may be harsh, they may be tough, but we are governed by law and not by caprice. That's what Dicey said. And then he looked at the French system and he said, you don't have the presumption of liberty, it has to be granted by the state, who may not be favorable to it, and you don't really have the rule of law because you have all these tribunals governing you and not proper judges. He got the French system, I should say, completely wrong. Even in that time, he didn't understand the French system, but they were his targets. And later on, when somebody, the dean of the law faculty in Paris University in the 1918 came to London, there's the famous discussion, his name was Barthélemy, and he came to London. And he met the professor, the very old Professor Dicey then, and he said to Professor Dicey, I have come to learn about administrative law, droit administratif. And Dicey said, in England, he said, we do not have droit administratif, we do not want it, and we will never have administrative law. In other words, we have these basic fundamental liberties deep in the common law. And that's all we need. We don't need your system. Right? So let me now just finish what I was saying about the rule of law. The rule of law has its skeptics, as I've said. But recently, I've been a member of what's called the Commission de Venise, the Venice Commission. This is the body, you may know, in the Conseil de l'Europe, the Council of Europe, which stands alongside the European Court of Human Rights and was formed in 1990, just after the fall of the Berlin Wall, actually, before the fall of the Soviet Union, in order to provide advice to the countries of the former Soviet Union on their constitution building. So you get two bodies in the Council of Europe. One is the court, and the other one is the Venice Commission, Commission de Venise, who provides advice to a number of countries And so the Russian constitution was first looked at by the Venice Commission, many other countries. It's a source now of soft constitutional law because they have reports on a number of subjects. And it's for students and PhD students, you probably know already, they have these things. But what I want, many of these reports. But the report that I want to refer to is a report in 2011 on the rule of law, supplemented just this year by une liste des critères de l'état de droit, a list of criteria, of checklist in English, on the rule of law, supplementing it. It's an important document for this reason, that it shows that the skeptics who say it's a Western concept, that it's too vague, were wrong in that the rule of law is not, it was accepted after much discussion. And some people said, we know the Rechtsstaat, and we know l'état de droit, and the Spanish equivalent. They all at the beginning said, we're different. But at the end, they all coalesced around the notion that the rule of law is a common European standard, probably universal standard. And if seen that way, it is described here, and also in a book which I would recommend to anyone interested in English law today, by Tom Bingham. He's the greatest judge in England recently. And he has this book titled The Rule of Law, which shows that it consists, he calls it 8 ingredients. I say 4 ingredients just for simplicity for the moment. Legality is number one, namely, everyone is under the law, as I've already said. But most important, officials, government ministers, bureaucracy must also be under the law. They must act lawfully within their powers. They must not have full powers. So there's legality. Then there is the second point, which is legal certainty. Law must be relatively certain. Of course, it can change, but there must be fair warning of any change. And you can't change the law retrospectively. So legal certainty is very important. This is important for all countries, and particularly for countries that try and attract investment, because business people need to know where they stand. They need to know that the law is stable and certain, and that is part of the rule of law. The third quality of the rule of law, and let me just go back one step. The rule of law is difficult to comprehend for us, I think, as much as in any other country, because it contains these 4 qualities that hang together but yet hang separately. They're very different questions. Legality is very different from certainty. Certainty is very different from equality. But you need all 4 to have the rule of law. The third one, so we have legality, certainty. Thirdly, equality, égalité. And for Dicey, he did accept equality in this sense. He said that the law must be applied equally between the rich, between the poor, between the marginalized, between the powerful. It ought to apply to everyone equally enforced. Now, so therefore, corruption is against the rule of law because it favors those who can pay for justice, that kind of thing. So that's equality. And finally, and this is what's important, very important, again, something different, but access to justice, access to the courts or equivalent bodies, the opportunity, and this is so vital, the opportunity to challenge a decision that is made about you by a public official in a court through a... Are we all right? Oh, a bird. It flew in from England this morning, so my friend. It's the bird of peace and harmony. So, access to justice through a fair trial before an independent judiciary. Okay, so that notion of access to justice is absolutely imperative to the rule of law. So the rule of law will not allow government to make decisions about you that you cannot challenge, but challenge must be a proper challenge. So therefore your trial has to be fair, and you have to have judges who won't always decide on the side of government or be paid by somebody to decide that way. Independence of the judiciary, absolutely crucial. Now, I just go one step back before we go forward and to ask the question, how do these principles play out with each other? And that is to say this, that Dicey, and I always have to go back to Dicey because his authority was so strong at the time and needs to be challenged in very different circumstances today. Dicey said that any discretionary power, pouvoir discretionnaire, was equivalent to arbitrariness. And that's where he overstated his case. And for many years, for those interested in this history, scholars and commentators such as Sir Ivor Jennings, Robson, and others, those who are working in the area, completely destroyed Dicey for a time, just for a time, because they said, you, in a complex state, you have to have discretionary power. Cannot act without some power to government. Things are too complicated today. And of course, they were right. But later on in the United Kingdom, we introduced our administrative law, our droit administratif, that Dicey did not like, and that is what allowed discretionary power to observe the rule of law, to be carried on in a way that was legal and reasonable and allowed fair hearings. So that's just an aside. Okay. What about, where does human rights come into this discussion? There is in England a view of the rule of law, which is a very formal one, and says it is all about procedure, about process. It has nothing to do with substance. It has, and therefore it doesn't have anything to do with human rights. You can have the rule of law, everything that I've set out there, particularly legal certainty, in a country that has slavery. You can have the rule of law in a country like China, where the rule of the party holds sway, and you cannot really seriously challenge some of the rules of the party. So these people say. They would say that you had the rule of law in South Africa during the time of apartheid because there was a law that everybody knew, but it was a certain law and it was enforced against everybody. But the other view, the view to which I subscribe, was known as the thick view of the rule of law rather than the thin view of the rule of law, is that the rule of law does itself contain human rights, like the right to a fair trial, like the notion of equality, legality, maybe not legal certainty, but to some extent an ex post facto law is set out in the European Convention as a convention right. And in addition, it gives you access to human rights through the challenge that you can make to decisions where human rights. So there is an overlap, certainly a very strong overlap, and access given to human rights through the rule of law. Okay, so now I come to the question. Without a written constitution, without formal protections, how can Parliament simply override the presumption of freedom and the rule of law? Can it decide in World War II, for example, that anybody of Jewish origin living in London had to be placed in not in prisons exactly, but in confinement, taken away from their universities and their schools and their orchestras and their daily lives and put in prison during the war because they were regarded as enemy aliens? against the rule of law, against the presumption of freedom, probably an illogical act because many of those people were refugees from Nazi Germany. Can Parliament do that? The answer is, in theory, they can and have done so. And in the Second World War, that's exactly what happened. And many other civil liberties during the conflict in the United Kingdom with Northern Ireland, with terrorism, more recently after 9/11, some of our civil liberties have been curtailed by Parliament. And can the courts then intervene and strike down that legislation for breach of the rule of law or the presumption of freedom? No, it has never been done. It has not been done. So that the strict legal position is, number one principle there is sovereignty of Parliament. And that's what allows the government, ultimate Parliament, the legislature, ultimate sway over anything else. Now, how has that changed over the years? And it has changed dramatically, but not yet possibly completely. How has it changed? First of all, World War II, the Second World War, taught us, and its aftermath taught us so much about the fact, I don't have to tell anybody in France this, but in England it's sometimes worth, people have to remember that World War II involved an elected government. Hitler was elected in 1933 by the people. And of course, in the Soviet Union, we were also looking at, if not an elected government, a very popular government supported by the popular will for many, many years. And we saw that during that time, we learned that democracy is not only about majority rule, but also about certain fundamental rights. Now, France knows this, the United States knows this, many other countries knows this, but in Britain, it was always felt that being, you know, moderate and sensible and not radical, and after all, this had developed over the years, we didn't need these rights because they were always inherent in our system. But after that time, I think people began to think again, is democracy only about the people voting or is it about something more than that? Of course, then we subscribe to a number of international instruments which become very important. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the late 40s, the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, the Convention on the Discrimination Against Women, the Rights of the Child, Social and Economic Rights, more recently the Convention Against Persons with Disabilities. The United Kingdom signed and ratified all these documents. When I say the United Kingdom, I say the United Kingdom executive, not Parliament, but the executive. And then, of course, there was the European Convention on Human Rights, which it signed and ratified in 1950, but only in 1966 did we allow individual petition to the European Court of So that was one element. How did those international treaties apply? The rule is, in England, it's a dualist system, not a monist system. So they would apply unless a law excluded them. And if the law was ambiguous, then it did not apply either. This is the way that this was done through the courts. Why? Why don't we have a monist system? Because of the sovereignty of Parliament again. It was the executive that signed up to these international treaties, not Parliament. So Parliament must have the last say on these matters. And if it legislates contrary to an international agreement, that legislation prevails. The second way in which things began to change was through administrative law. Droit administratif that I've mentioned now four times, but was terribly important because people began to be able to challenge decisions made about them by all public officials in the courts. And we began very quickly and suddenly to develop this notion that the courts would look carefully. Was the power lawful? Was it within the power given by Parliament? And they would interpret that very broadly in favor of the individual because of the presumption of liberty. And was the power reasonably exercised? Was it exercised in a way that was not unduly harsh, unduly oppressive? Again, exercising in favor of the presumption of liberty. And did you give that person the opportunity to participate in the decision? A notion that come from the rule of law, which is a fair hearing, even in an administrative situation. Doesn't have to only appear in the courts of law, that fair hearing. And this was the greatest development of British law from about the mid-1960s to this day. All through the common law, judge-made law. The judges suddenly also getting the mood and saying, we live in a, not only in a democracy that involves parliamentary sovereignty, but now we know, in particular for us, after the Second World War, and what happened in the Soviet Union and in other places as well, and in Germany at the time, we know that democracy is a broader concept than simple sovereignty of parliament. We can't do much about it as judges except interpret powers in a way that is favorable to the citizen in the narrowest possible way. And then so we've got international forces, we've got judicial review of administration. We have the European Union. Now, Britain signed up to the European Union, and there was a referendum in the 1970s, so the people spoke as well. And that gave our accession to the EU a certain legitimacy, a special legitimacy, so much so that directives from the European Union applied directly in the United Kingdom, and they prevail. They are sovereign over any British legislation. That's the one area in our law where the sovereignty of Parliament is overridden by another form of law, and that is the law coming out of the European Union. Now, you may know, and for those working in this area, that we're holding another referendum in precisely 1 month's time, on the 23rd of June, where to come out of the European Union, because there are many people in the United Kingdom that are not happy about those bureaucrats in Brussels telling us here what to do. And for that reason, and for other reasons, there is a very strong campaign for Brexit, British exit from the EU. It's neck and neck at the moment, although recent polls show that the Stay and the Remain campaign seems to be making headway, but who knows. But it's very interesting that that's the one area where the sovereignty of Parliament is being overridden. I don't want to bore you with too many details, but there are two more aspects. I'll come to the Human Rights Act in a moment and the Convention on Human Rights. But there's another area before that which is also important, and that is Britain used to be, even until about 20 years ago, a very, very unified, very centralized country. It had local government, but not much regional government. But since 1998, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland have been given considerable autonomy in different areas. They have many powers of their own. It would be quite impossible now, practically, for the government or parliament to take back those powers over education, over health, complete education, and more powers over the budget. It would be quite impossible now to take any of those powers back practically, politically, Legally, however, they still could. But you've got to add that aspect to what we call devolution. You've got to add devolution to the list of aspects that are chipping away step by step, little by little, at the doctrine of complete parliamentary sovereignty. So that's something else that's come into the picture. And then we must talk about the European Convention on Human Rights and how that plays within the United Kingdom. Now, for many years, from 1950 up to 1998, the European Convention, the ECHR, was simply an international treaty obligation. And as I said, that could be overridden by local law. So Article 10, which provides freedom of expression, would be overridden by a United Kingdom statute that gives power to the minister to forbid certain groups in Northern Ireland or other terrorist groups, as they were called, access to the media. Took away their free speech. And when it was when the ECHR was a convention, was an international instrument, that would override the Article 10. The minister was able to do that. Over that time, between 1950 and 1998, there were about 300 judgments of the European Court of Human Rights which held that the United Kingdom had violated convention rights. So people began to think, maybe we're not as perfect in our adherence to these rights that we originally thought. They had to do with issues of taking passports away from British nationals who were refugees from former colonies such as Kenya, forbidding their entry into the United Kingdom, although they were British citizens. Beatings of children in schools, minor punishments, all that sort of thing, very familiar to you as part of the initial jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. Many of those cases came out of British cases. Access to the media for all sorts of issues and so on. And a mood began to develop, particularly in a country that was becoming more diverse racially, religiously, was where there were issues about terrorism. I'm not talking about post 9/11, I'm talking about the Northern Ireland issues and so on. And there were really serious challenges to the rule of law, that the time had come where liberties should no longer have a residual character or a negative character. The time had come to make them positive entitlements. And the Labour government, under Tony Blair of 1997, enacted the Human Rights Act, which had the effect of incorporating into British law what was formerly a treaty obligation, the European Convention of Human Rights. Now, what does that do to sovereignty of Parliament? The Act was a compromise between, it still left some room for parliamentary sovereignty. It did not allow, first of all, I should say that it applies to all Human Rights Act now, which is adopting the convention rights into English law, into British law, I should say, applies to all public officials. So in administrative law, it is there, it is everywhere. For anybody who's acting under the power of Parliament as an official, they have to obey the European Convention's standards. But in terms of a statute itself, there's no strike-down power, as there used not to be until fairly recently here in France. The courts can only issue a declaration of incompatibility, with convention rights. So if there's a law, for example, that does not that takes away the rights to a fair trial or allows detention without trial for a long period to people who are suspected of terrorism, the courts cannot disapply that law. They can't strike it down. But they can declare it incompatible. And then the question is, and then the government has discretion as to whether to change the law. In every case except one, maybe one and a half, but we needn't talk about the half. In any case except one, the Parliament has abided by the court's decision. And in doing so, the court must take into account the jurisprudence of Strasbourg, of the Strasbourg court. It needn't slavishly follow it, but it must take it into account. It's what's been called the mirror principle, because this jurisprudence of the Strasbourg court has been developed all over Europe, and we're in that system. We must try to be consistent where possible. There's also another provision that requires us, before a declaration of incompatibility, all the judges must, where possible, interpret the law so as to be favorable to the convention. It's also known as an interpretive obligation. So you try and bend a law, which means reading down the law or reading up the law, as far as possible, without necessarily legislating or amending a law, but as far as possible, just try and bend the law to be consistent with Strasbourg jurisprudence. It's a law that is interesting in that it involves not only what the courts do, but also tries to bring Parliament and the executive into the system. It provides a holistic approach. How does it take Parliament into the system? Before any bill becomes into Parliament, projet de loi, before it comes to Parliament, there has to be a declaration that it is or is not compatible with convention rights. So that's a way where, right at the beginning, you're getting the officials and the legislators to think when they bring it, hey, will this pass Strasbourg at the end of the day? And then there's a way, if the law has been declared incompatible, very quickly, through a fast-track system, to bring it back, to amend the law. There's also something very important, which is there is a joint committee on human rights between the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and that is a committee of Parliament, which has become a very powerful committee, which examines any possible breaches of human rights and issues like prisoner voting, for example, in respect of human rights. Well, it's beginning to look at it, hasn't looked at that yet. And to bring that into and to have publicity about that particular issue. That sort of ends my description of the system, except to say this, that there is great dissatisfaction with the present government, Cameron's government, with the Human Rights Act. There are a number of people on the right and left of the political system, but particularly on the right, who believe still, echoing the view of the European Union, the opposition to the European Union, that having ourselves judged by Strasbourg jurisprudence is constitutionally illegitimate. They also feel that the jurisprudence coming from Strasbourg is too inventive. You know, the view that the European Convention is a living instrument and that it must change to take into account the rights of transsexuals, of adoption of homosexual households, of assisted suicide. That kind of view is too much for many of the parliamentarians in the United Kingdom, and other countries have the similar anxiety about judicial lawmaking, which is at that high level. There are others, and I count myself among them, who feel that these restraints on parliamentary sovereignty and these ideas about rights and freedoms have hugely enriched our system, and that the Strasbourg Court has done a fantastic job in actually providing what Monsieur Badinter once described, and I heard him say it, is a common human rights law for Europe out of the ashes of the late 40s, and has been so successful in that. They also feel that if Britain were to come out of the European Convention, which is, I think, now a very not a strong possibility, but is still a possibility, that it will weaken the whole system, in that champagne corks will be popping in certain countries in Eastern and Central Europe that describe themselves nowadays as illiberal democracies, increasingly numerous, alas. And let me conclude very briefly by talking about the question of prisoners' votes. Now, one of the decisions recently of the European Court of Human Rights in the case of Hirst, H-I-R-S-T, has to do with the rights of people in prisons, in jails in the United Kingdom to have a vote. And in 1983, it was decided in the UK that in future no prisoners would have a vote. It's what known as a blanket ban. There are no exceptions. Now, it was held that the court, giving a margin of appreciation to the United Kingdom and later to Italy and other countries on this matter, that there was, first of all, under Article 3 of Protocol 1 of the ECHR, a right to vote. That's what they first said. You'll know how that's framed. It doesn't give you a right to vote in the convention. What it says is that signatory states should hold free elections, under conditions which ensure the free expression of the opinion of the people. So there's no right there. But the European Court interpreted that as a right. They then said they must give a margin of appreciation to countries to decide which prisoners they want to vote. But the United Kingdom's blanket ban on all prisoners didn't meet the test of proportionality and what was necessary in a democratic society. And the discussions in Parliament were not sufficiently full and complex on that question. So they held that the United Kingdom was violating this convention right, and the same has been held of other countries, as I've said, and the same applies to France, whereas in the case of Thierry Delvigne, and the matter has been discussed not in the European Court of Human Rights, but in the Court of Justice of the European Union, where it is held that because France did not apply a blanket ban, as I understand it, there was no breach of, not of the European Convention, but of the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union. So the French case took a different route, and was there, the exceptions there proved to be proportionate. Now, the problem in Britain at the moment is that this case is being used politically. After all, who could be more, if the rights are there to help unpopular minorities, who could be more unpopular than prisoners? After all, they're convicted of crimes. And who could be more unpopular than Mr. Hearst, who was a man who created, who was a murderer, with a sharp knife. He's the most unlikely person to evoke the sympathies of the public relations company. A very difficult case to plead. But nevertheless, how would we resolve this in our law at the moment if it were to come back to an English court? And this is how the reasoning would probably go. And I give it to you simply because this is the way we would resolve these inconsistencies between the presumption of freedom, the rule of law, and the sovereignty of Parliament. Sovereignty of Parliament would argue that this is absolutely a matter for Parliament. As Mr. Cameron says, "It makes me feel sick," he said, "physically sick," this is what he said, "to have the thought of prisoners voting." And this is a visceral reaction, a view from nausea rather than from logic, which politicians tend to adopt. After all, they want popular support. So that's the view that they would adopt. And he would say, parliamentary sovereignty here. It's not only about, it's also about punishment. We feel that prisoners need to be punished in this way by having one of their fundamental rights taken away. If I were acting for the prisoner on the other side and trying to build a constitutional argument, my argument would go something like the following. First of all, there is a presumption of liberty. I started by talking about that. I bring it in towards the end now. And there are a number of cases in our courts where prisoners have been denied access. For example, their correspondence has been stopped when they're writing to their lawyers. And the judges have said, in the case of Leach, in the case of Raymond and Honey, there is a constitutional right of access to justice. It is part of the rule of law. It is what I said is the fourth element of the rule of law, access to justice. And anybody, even somebody in prison, has the right to write to his lawyer to say that I have not got proper access, that I want to challenge a decision of a prison officer. And there's the presumption that even prisoners have rights that are given to them, but also and that they do not lose by necessary implication. Now, what rights do they lose by necessary implication? The right to physical freedom, the right to carry on with their family life under Article 8, and the right to carry on with their employment. Do they lose other rights? Do they lose the right not to be tortured? No. We would say no capital punishment as well. And we would say that they have the right to correspond. They have some Article 8 rights, such as the right to correspond with their family or certainly with their lawyers. And if they are punished within prison, they have a right to representation. And they can't be given solitary confinement because that would be cruel and and degrading punishment. So of course they retain a number of their rights under the presumption of freedom. And so this is how the presumption of freedom could come into this argument. The Hearst was decided in the High Court, not the higher courts, but the first instance court. But none of these arguments were made. It was a very rapid case, very unfortunate case in a way. So first of all, we have the presumption of freedom. Then we would construct another argument from equality. The fundamental aspect of the right to vote, in a way, represents the right to equality at its very highest level, because what it does say is that every person is equal, and every person has an equal say, however rich you are, however poor. If you have universal franchise, one vote, simply each vote counts equally, and that the most fundamental manifestation of equality is in the notion of the universal franchise. There was a wonderful case before the South African Constitutional Court called August v. Electoral Commission, where the it was said, the universality of the franchise is important not only for nationhood and democracy. The vote of every citizen is a badge of dignity and personhood. Quite literally, it says that everybody counts. So that's the second argument would be made. And a third argument could be made from the notion of parliamentary sovereignty. Parliamentary sovereignty only has legitimacy from the fact that Parliament represents the people. And if 90,000 prisoners in the United Kingdom are withdrawn from franchise, then surely Parliament does not have that legitimacy in respect of them to make those kind of decisions. So those are the kinds of arguments. I could expand on any of those, and some of them need still to be made. But you will see the kind of thinking, the fact that even though we have no written constitution, we nevertheless do have constitutional rights, and that those rights are based not in any one law, and sometimes in no written law at all, but in a principle which derives its authority from the fact that we are striving, but not always succeeding, as in any country in the world, to be a constitutional democracy based on the will of the people and the rule of law. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for presenting all these modern challenges of the rule of law in your country. And I have to, just before we open a discussion, I have to say that Britain, the United Kingdom, for comparative constitutional lawyers, is a very interesting case, even a mystery, because more and more we have in continental Europe, in the United States, in Canada, in India, and even Australia, we have a new definition of a rule of law, which includes judicial review. And in the UK, you have a constitutional democracy without judicial review. And most of all, this is why it's kind of not only a mystery but a worry for us, is that we have, in the same time, organizations like the World Justice Project, which publishes every year a rule of law index, which puts the United Kingdom on, like, at a number 5 position, just after some Scandinavian countries, and before Germany, and way before France, and before the United States. So I think it'd be good if we could have some discussion today to take advantage of your presence here, so we could understand how, in your country, you can successfully find some compatibility with, you know, and well, you mentioned the difficulties of it, but you have this long tradition of success on making compatible this parliamentary democracy without judicial review of legislation and the rule of law, which the rule of law, and mainly among all the criteria you mentioned, I agree with access to justice and all that, but mainly with all these fundamental rights, which seem in the past, in many cases, better protected country without judicial review, maybe than here for some of them. But all questions are welcome, either on this situation or on more current aspects like this coming referendum. I think we should maybe try to have more of you on that issue. You can't tell us the result yet. I know that, but maybe about the, we could discuss the constitutional challenges of this referendum and maybe what is the government going to do? Is it a very mandatory consultation?
Yes. Should I answer that brief question first? Sure,
yeah, please. Okay. This way they can think of questions.
Okay, and I'm happy to take questions in French. If I don't understand, you'll help me.
Yes. French or English?
To answer the question about European Union, there's one thing, sorry, I've just remembered what I did not say a decision of Strasbourg that has not yet been implemented. It's the one decision that I was referring to. That is the one that has not been implemented in the UK. And Article 46 of the European Convention requires Britain, all signatories, to implement the decisions of the Strasbourg Court. So we are in breach of that. Talk about the rule of law there. It is a breach of our international obligation there. So that is something we should certainly have to think about. In answer to your question about what will happen if the referendum is in favour of Brexit, I think the answer is pure chaos, because it will take at least 5 years to dismantle the system of European law, which does not go everywhere in our system, but is very deep within the system, in environment, in competition law, concurrence, in all commercial transactions, in health and safety legislation. Just about everywhere you look, there are contract law installed in deep in our system. So that will all have to be untangled, and we'll have to make our own laws on all that. Goodness me. The economy is likely to suffer, that's absolutely clear. All the evidence has been coming out, not all, I would say 90% of the evidence is that we will suffer. The voice of Britain in Europe and in the world, Mr. Obama, came all the way to the United Kingdom to try and persuade us that we are better in and will be very weak and isolated outside of the European Union. That security is another area where we combine efforts. Now, we will probably, in some of these areas, be able to renegotiate a deal, but it's not certain. And it's also, we will negotiate a deal in a bit like Norway, which gets a number of benefits from being part of the single market and so on, but has no voice within the European Union. So we'll lose any voice that we might now have. As far as immigration is concerned, that's another area. There are some who think that they'll be less prone to have many, many immigrants from the new countries that may come in the future, in particular in the EU. But there are others who would say, and I would be among them, that the United Kingdom has benefited enormously from immigration. And many of the key jobs in our economy are being held by immigrants, temporary from Europe or permanent sometimes, that would not be held by British alone. And we would soon reach the state of full employment and would be seeking desperately to, if we wanted the economy to continue, to employ employment from the outside. And we also feel, maybe arrogantly, that Europe itself might be weakened with certain countries. France may be one among them, who would then also decide to leave, because these things often have a snowballing effect, and all the great work that has been done will be dismantled. So it could be very serious. But I do believe that at the moment it seems that the arguments in favour of remaining in Europe are holding sway.
Could you say a little bit more about the constitutional environment of this referendum? Like is it really part of a rule of law?
You may imagine. It was a referendum that was called by the Prime Minister. It's one of his powers to do that. Because at the time he was very worried about the movement known as the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, which seemed very strong and was gaining members from his own worried that he would lose his, he would be powerless, not because of the opposition Labour Party, but because his own members were beginning to come over into UKIP. This was at a time just before the previous election, when he was in coalition government with the Liberal Democratic Party. So he promised, as part of the manifesto commitment after the election, that he would hold a referendum in order to hold on to those members. They got what they wanted. He also agreed